Anyways, the next talk will be by Anne, who you might probably all know. Her husband was prosecuted because he had access to a library, and he was sort of intellectual. He had knowledge, and you know, you probably have read all these formulations, things they suggested. But this talk will actually not be very much about him. It will be about other cases all over the world, where similar terrorist laws have been applied to prosecute innocent citizens, or basically drastically misused. And this misuse is quite a danger for society, I think. And I guess this will be very interesting, because I don't think much has been publicized on that yet. So I hope you enjoy the talk, and please clear the pathways. That'd be very, very great. Anyways, have fun.
Hi, and thank you all for coming, and please don't pose any further security threats. We'll be talking enough about other dangers for security today. Maybe some of you saw me here last year when I talked about the case against André Holm, who's not my husband but my partner, which doesn't really make much of a difference. Last year I was quite shocked about having experienced such an arrest in the family and a terrorism charge, and by now I'm not much less shocked but slightly used to the fact. And in the course of the last year I have of course focused myself a lot on cases of terrorism. And in the time, I noticed that there's many such cases, and I would like to introduce some of these to you today, because I think there's many others who are similarly strange and absurd in the way they are being run, and not all of them have so much public attention. I think that the public perception of what terrorism is generally goes along rather with what actually the current EU definition of terrorism is. This definition of 2002 says terrorism offenses are committed with the aim of seriously intimidating a population or unduly compelling a government or international organization to perform or abstain from performing an act, or seriously destabilizing or destroying the fundamental political, constitutional, economic, or social structures of a country or an international organization. I think the general perception of terrorism is that involves massive violence against people, many deaths, and probably some kind of situation that creates danger for a government or a state in itself. The cases that I'm going to talk to you about don't fit that description very well in my perception. I would like to say, though, that of course the information that I have about these cases is not complete. In most cases, the investigation is still going on. It's not quite clear what really happened, and the investigation is running and the files are generally not public, so I will tell you the best of what I know, but it may not be the complete information that we might find out about later when the cases will be closed eventually. I hope so. And of course, in cases like this, political views are involved, and there's often many different views, specifically differences between the prosecution and the defendants. And I will also, of course, leave out some of the details, because I will just give a basic overview of what is going on. The first case I would like to talk about is a case that took place in Nottingham, Great Britain, where on May 14th of this year, two members of the university were arrested under the Terrorism Act of 2000 of Great Britain. Their names are Hicham Yeza and Rizwan Sabir. And they were arrested because they had copies of the Al-Qaeda training manual on their computers, One of the two had downloaded this from the United States Department of Justice website. He's a member of the university's Politics and International Relations Department. He was researching terrorism for his postgraduate studies. He was writing a PhD on the strategies of Al-Qaeda. He asked his friend and colleague Hicham, who is a former student and now works at the university, to help him with his PhD and specifically with printing out the huge document. Hicham, who used to be a member of the Senate of the Nottingham University, who is an editor of different magazine, now worked for the university in the administration, and both were arrested and held in police custody for 6 days before they were released without a charge. The charge, to begin with, was terrorism, like I said. It was then decided to not charge Hicham, who was mostly accused of the two, under the Terrorism Act. But when they were released after 6 days, he was rearrested for charges under the Immigration Act. It was also said later that if both had been maybe of Norwegian origin and maybe were blonde, then probably this wouldn't have been such a problem, but being of Arabic background, they completely fitted the stereotype of Muslim terrorists in the United Kingdom. He was rearrested under the Immigration Act, and an order for fast-track deportation was issued on May 23rd, and a deportation flight was scheduled for June 1st. This is 2 weeks after his first arrest. He had been in the UK for 13 years of residence and now had a planned deportation in less than 3 weeks after the arrest for the under the Terrorism Act. He was then moved around for 3 weeks from one immigration removal centre to the next, and after a huge protest campaign, of which you can see one picture, which was quite impressive, I find, he was released on bail. As far as I know, the investigation concerning his possible problems with immigration laws is still going on. On the website of the campaign, there is no complete up-to-date information as to what the situation is now, but I found it rather striking that that they were arrested to begin with. Rizwan, the one who had downloaded the manual, later said in an interview, "If they had just asked my professor why I was looking at this material, they would have understood that it was research. Instead, they chose to start an anti-terror investigation." What struck me in this case is a similarity to the case that we are as a family confronted with, which is that also here an academic is concerned, and a nice similarity is that there was a huge wave of support. The biggest demonstration ever that took place at the University of Nottingham was taking place for his support, and it is widely believed that this public support also helped to release and to drop the charges for terrorism. The next case I would like to talk about is a case that took place, or is actually still taking place, in Portugal. This is the British suspect. And the case in Portugal is a case against 150 activists who, in the August of 2007, destroyed a field of genetically modified corn plants of 1 hectare in size. This field is located in the region of Algarve, the first region in Portugal that was declared GMO-free by local authorities. It was the first time this kind of action was being carried out in Portugal. In other countries, this takes place more often, particularly in Germany. This kind of so-called mowing of GMO plant fields is actually quite common. It is considered more an action of civil disobedience, not necessarily by the owners of the fields, but by the activists. It is not considered a majorly violent action, but is tried to be seen as civil disobedience against something that is hard to protest against, which is genetically modified organisms being used now and endangering nature. This action took place during the day with press present, and until today there is a video online with a documentation of the action and reactions by the public, and especially the owner of the field. It is in no way what you would expect to be a terrorist action that is hidden in the dark, where it's impossible to identify anyone and impossible to really see what was going on. The video I find extremely interesting to see because it also includes many statements of the people who were involved. After this happened, there were strong reactions in the Portuguese media. The owner of the field received a visit by the Minister of Agriculture, by the Minister of Internal Affairs, who promised investigations, and by the President of the Portuguese Republic, who condemned the action and announced it must be punished. In September, the investigation went on. So far, there are no formal charges, but they are being threatened against the activists who don't really know what they will be facing, and the action was classified by the government as terrorism and in result also by Europol, who is collecting and doing statistics on cases of terrorism in the European Union. Europol said that in other cases that are falling in this field of so-called single-issue activities, terrorism cases are divided into left-wing terrorism, right-wing terrorism, Muslim fundamentalist terrorism, and then there's a so-called single-issue terrorism. And normally these cases of single-issue activities are declared to be extremist, but not terrorism. Portugal chose to have this, the first case, to be investigated under the new Portuguese law against terrorism. To have their first case of terrorism also. And so the only case of terrorism in Portugal that is reported in the Europol report for 2007 is this case of 150 activists who during the day trampled across a cornfield. There's one other case which is of right-wing extremism, which is an entirely different matter, of course. This case doesn't really have much similarity to the case against André Holm, but basically, it's a form of action. What that's maybe similar that or vaguely similar that is labeled terrorism, which normally is not that uncommon. It's the first time in Portugal that something like this happened, and it is quite obvious that the activists didn't expect this kind of reaction. They did not expect to be prosecuted as terrorists. And one could argue that the actions of the militant group, which is what André is still accused to be a member of, are also mostly symbolic actions. It's not violence against people. Nobody was ever hurt. It's mostly paint bombs against, for example, unemployment agencies, cars being burned, or minor property damage. The next case I would like to talk about is a case that took place in Austria, also in May this year, when 10 people were arrested through armed police in Vienna. According to the Austrian paragraph 278A of the Austrian Penal Code, which is the law that punishes forming a criminal organization, which was introduced already in 1993. This is the only case that doesn't directly involve terrorism, but has many similarities nonetheless. 23 apartments, houses, and offices were searched. Doors were kicked in by masked officers with weapons drawn. And the cause for the arrests were called the danger of suppression of evidence and the danger of committing a crime. Suppression of evidence was seen as a danger because some of the suspects had used encryption and might do so again. Danger of committing a crime was seen in the fact that some of the suspects had been politically active around issues of animal rights or animal protection. There is not visible any clear evidence that the suspects were actually involved in the attacks that they were accused of, and these attacks are the first strong case they were accused of having participated in was an assumed arson attack against a hunting lodge. And in fact, it was found out later that this was caused by an oven of this lodge, which didn't work properly. And the other things that are left in the investigation now are mostly things like broken windows or glue in some door locks, graffiti, sabotaged deer stands. They were accused of sabotage of animal hunting, and in fact what happened was that people made noise during animal hunting, and this is a sabotage. Also, there were several stink bombs against fur-selling stores. All 10 activists openly admit that they are engaged in either animal rights groups or animal protection groups, and that's an interesting thing also. They are accused of being a criminal organization, 10 people, but the 10 people that were arrested are part of two very different groups who actually don't like each other very much for ideological reasons. One are the more, you might say, radical animal rights activists, and the other is the more NGO-type animal protection group that do lobbying. Also demonstrations, but in a nicer way, if you want. The evidence that was found were tools that you can find in any household, mobile phones, T-shirts with logos, spray paints, which is a proof of their political activism. And the interesting thing also in this case is that this kind of Austrian criminal organization needs at least 10 people so that a criminal organization can be seen, and 10 people were arrested. They didn't all know each other, they definitely don't like each other all very well, but they are one criminal organization. This paragraph 278A, I was told by some of the activists I met in fall of this year, is designed to prosecute organizations regarded as organized crime. Most countries have laws like this, and specifically was used mostly like mafia-like organizations so far, and it was the first time it was used against political activists. Everyone was arrested in May, like I said, and they were actually in pretrial detention for 3 months, except for one person who was released 1 month earlier, for no visible evidence other than, like I said, using encryption and similarly hard evidence. The similarity here may be same as this for Andre, is that there was no real evidence presented. The evidence that was used is mostly, if you want, ideological. They were accused of having been active around animal rights, and this was apparently enough to then start an investigation with a lot of surveillance and observation in the months before, which led to gathering of little bits and pieces that are the said spray paint or logos or involvement in demonstrations, etc. Andre did a talk about his own case, I think, in April or March of this year, and there was someone from Austria in the audience who then said, "My God, this is terrible that you have something like this happening in Germany. I'm glad that I live in a kind of innocent paradise where this would never happen." And in May, he got an email by the same person saying, "Okay, I need to take this back because now we've also had the same thing in Austria." Like I said, everybody was released. The charges are still being investigated, and it's unclear what is going to become of these 10 people who have spent 3 months in prison, basically, for, I would say, well, not nothing, but not very much. The next case I would like to talk about took place in New Zealand, where in October of 2007, more than 300 special forces police did raids in dozens of houses all over New Zealand, mostly in Maori. This is the indigenous communities of New Zealand. This included, for example, a school bus of kindergarten kids that was stopped and searched with drawn weapons, 60 houses being searched, a complete village being shut off. And the police said this was the response to concrete terrorist threats by indigenous activists. The result was 12 arrests under the recently created anti-terrorism legislation. And after the arrests, the Solicitor General, which is the Vice State Prosecutor of New Zealand, actually decided that this could not be a terrorism charge with the evidence that was presented, but it was in the media and for the arrested first presented as now you are being charged with the Terrorism Act. Arrests were being made nonetheless, but after 4 weeks, all 12 were released. Today, 8 people face charges under the Arms Act for alleged participation in paramilitary-style training camps, and 5 people are also charged with being members of an organized criminal group. Also needs to be said here that New Zealand passed a new anti-terror law after 9/11, and this was the first case that was being tried under this new anti-terrorism law of New Zealand. The terrorism charge was not accepted, but the Arms Act, if they would be judged by that, would lead to 4 years of prison, and the criminal organization would result in up to 5 years of prison. The current situation is that pre-trial hearings are going on, which is illegal. Well, all countries have different legal situations, and many of the Anglo-Saxon countries have this thing where they have pre-trial hearings, and only then it is decided whether a formal trial is actually started in court. And this is going on in New Zealand now for months already, and the people who are concerned say that they expect the trial maybe to start in the end of 2009. Interesting detail I find is that, since I'm talking to a chaos congress here, that the police think that an encrypted chat room was used to organize the training camps, and this encrypted chat is to be found at http://voodoochat.net. And the police apparently didn't manage to break into this chat, and therefore thinks that this is a highly conspiratorial method to organize very dangerous things just because they couldn't open it. They have no idea of what actually was talked about or organized in this. Also in the raids, several servers were confiscated, with the result that different Maori websites disappeared and are not back online until today. The public attention in this case in New Zealand was rather high, obviously. I remember finding media reports also in German or different media outside New Zealand about this case, but the attention decreased naturally after the decision not to charge under the Terrorism Act. The investigation is still going on, though, and the possible sentences that might come out of this are quite hard. What is interesting in the context of New Zealand, that last week it became known that a police informant was uncovered, who had informed police about animal rights groups, environmental groups, unions, peace groups, and the Green Party. His reports include not only details about communication methods, but also phone numbers, demonstration plans, etc., but also information on sexual relationships, travel plans, or sources of income. This is not very surprising. I mean, we all probably assume that police are using informants in any kind of community that they consider of interest for whatever reason, so that's not really surprising, but I find it rather rare that it is possible to actually find out details about how this work is being done. And it's actually quite interesting how this was done. This person who had been an informant for more than 10 years in the New Zealand activist communities had his computer broken and asked his girlfriend, who's a computer programmer, to fix his computer. She found strange emails on his computer that he apparently didn't bother to hide very well, and installed some spyware on his phone to monitor his text messages and calls, and set a script on his computer to continue sending his emails to her. She even downloaded a year's worth of phone bills and decrypted documents he had encrypted, and as a result, it became clear that he was communicating and working for the police. The similarity in this case to the case against Andre and the militant group in Germany is that in the beginning there was a huge public attention, and this is a similarity in many of these cases. As long as it is a terrorism case and after the terrorism charge drops, people seem to think, okay, so now we are back to legal, democratic law, state kind of structures, and everything is fine. But in fact, investigations are still going on, but under a different paragraph of the penal code. This is from a demonstration from the support groups in New Zealand. Next, I would like to talk about the United States. In the United States, something is going on that is labeled the Green Scare, to describe legal actions of the US government against environmental and animal rights activists in the United States. The FBI calls them animal rights extremists and eco-terrorists. It's a term similar to what was used during the McCarthy era in the 50s, the Red Scare. The topic eco-terrorism appeared in 2002 in a hearing in Congress. the U.S. Congress. And since 2000, there have been more than 20 cases of investigations and trials. Two groups are the main targets of the Green Scare, and they are the Animal Liberation Front, the ALF, and the Earth Liberation Front, the ELF. Their actions comprise what could be described as politically motivated property destruction, including large financial damage, e.g. arson to luxury villas seen as symbols of excessive consumerism, lumber companies, destructions of SUVs, releasing animals from fur farms, damage of e.g. telephone towers, and many other different things. The ELF, the Earth Liberation Front, was made the number one of the domestic terrorist threat list by the FBI. I am quoting now, "The number one domestic terrorism threat is the eco-terrorism and animal rights movement." This is a quote from CNN. And we are not talking about Al-Qaeda here or Muslim fundamentalism. This is animal rights activists with doing a lot of damage. Some of the examples of cases that were put on trial here is a rather famous person. His name is Jeff Lures. He was convicted to 23 years of jail because he set three SUVs on fire. SUVs are these suburban vehicles, these huge cars that are now riding around everywhere that use a lot of gas and actually are not really a good example of environmental way of living. He did this, so he said, as a protest against excessive consumption and global warming in 2000 and 2001, when this was not yet a very prominent topic of debate. He was sentenced to 23 years of jail for this, and this was later reduced to 10 years. He is still in prison. Another example is what's called the Shack 7. They are six animal rights activists who were convicted in March of 2006 to 24 years in prison for, I'm quoting, using their website to incite hate, harassment, vandalism, and attacks against the company Huntington Life Sciences, who are running animal testing laboratories. In the words of their supporters on their website, they describe this as a website that reported on and expressed ideological support for protest activity against Huntington and its business affiliates. They were not accused of having been engaged in terrorist or threatening acts, but they were accused to conspire to promote terrorism. And for this are in prison, all of them, to 24 years. The law that is being used here mostly is a law that used to be called the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act and is now called the Animal Enterprise Protection Act, first introduced in 1992. Another example is what is called the Operation Backfire. This is an investigation run by the FBI, and they are actually calling this the Operation Backfire since 2004. The FBI, and there's differing information also on the FBI websites, if you dare to go there. And my impression from this is that they have been looking for a group called The Family for 10 years. Initially because this group is said to have burned down the ski resort in Colorado, causing $26 million of damage. In some reports, it says this caused $12 million of damage, either in 98 or 96. And the activists who are members of this said group are either members of the Earth Liberation Front and or the Animal Liberation Front. They are accused of having done up to 25 actions of either $48 million of damage or $80 million. Yes, again, different information. Doing vandalism, property damage, animal releases, and arson. In 2004, local, state, and federal investigations were combined to this one investigation called the Operation Backfire. And I'm quoting again, the defendants are accused of attacks on federal land and animal management sites, private meatpacking plants, lumber facilities, and a car dealership with damages here reaching $80 million. So far, 17 people were indicted, and in these indictments, in these trials, 15 pled guilty of their actions. And so far, the FBI is still looking for 4 people to be members of this group, and there is a $50,000 reward per person set out for any information leading to arrest of these people. Another case, and that's not a picture to the case, just another illustrating some of the material that is being produced by the supporters of these cases. Another case is one that was sentenced also in 2008, is against a woman called Brianna Waters, who was sentenced to 6 years of prison for an arson attack against a university building in Washington State. She is, I think, 32 or maybe 33 years old now. She has a daughter of 3 years and is a violin teacher who used to live in California. And what describes her also is that she used to be the partner of one of the suspects in these arson cases, who is still being one, who is one of these 4 that is are still looked for. She was arrested in 2005 and later released. Now she's serving a prison term. And the interesting thing about this case is that she herself says she's innocent. She was not involved in these attacks at all, but she was accused of someone who was also charged in the same case. And she was charged to be the lookout in an arson attack against the building of the University of Washington that comprised research facilities about genetically modified trees. This charge could have led to a sentence of up to 35 years of prison. And the interesting thing that I didn't know about the U.S. legal system before is that if you are accused of something and you pled that, and you're saying you're not guilty, you're innocent of the charge, then you might receive this full sentence of so many years. But if you agree to a deal with the prosecutor and the court, then you can considerably reduce the possible sentence, either because you accept that you are guilty, which is something I still don't understand why being guilty reduces your sentence, but that works. And the other more important part is that if you agree to testify about other suspects, then this will also extremely reduce your sentence. And this is what happened in this case. Brianna Waters said she's innocent, she doesn't have to do anything with the attacks, but to other people who also were facing a minimum of 30 years of prison, testified about her and said she was involved, and the result was that one was then facing only 3 to 5 years and the other 5 to 7 years of prison. This is basically an invitation to lie about other people. When you do, you will get a much lesser sentence, which is not a very nice thing to do, obviously. But then on the other hand, if you face 35 years or 50 years or hundreds of years in prison and you are told, if you tell us this and that story, you might end up with just 5 or 10, I think it's very hard to point fingers. The result, however, is very hard. In this case, it's Brianna Waters being in prison who said there is no evidence other than these testimonies and no other evidence that actually proves her to be involved. In the United States, and that I think is also very, very special here, is that there is a general atmosphere of fear. I think nobody of us would be surprised to hear about that. Already here, I talk to a lot of people who tell me, I'm scared to look at your website, I'm scared to call you, I'm scared to Google certain terms because I know all of this is being monitored. But in the US, I think this is many times harder and many more tense. There's no fly lists that when you ever get targeted as somehow involved in suspicious activities, you may not be able to fly. There is 1 million people on the so-called terrorism watch list who have some kind of consequences, and it's very difficult to detect how you get to be on these lists, and it's even more difficult and practically impossible with legal methods to get out of this again. So the result is that most people don't dare to, for example, express support when other people are concerned. A different case from the United States, apart from this green scare, Oh, and this is also something that I thought was really quite amazing. That is an anonymous ad placed in different big papers in the United States, which concerns the New York Stock Exchange and how this is being threatened by terrorism. The next case that I would like to talk about is the case against the Critical Art Ensemble, which some of you may have heard about. It's a case that became known in 2004 when the Joint Terrorism Task Force detained the artist and professor Steve Kurtz of the Critical Art Ensemble, which is an art and theater collective. And what happened is that he was at home with his wife and she suddenly died during the night of a heart failure. He called the emergency number, emergency doctors came, and they saw that there was material for an exhibition on biotechnology, and the doctors called the police. Police instantly started a bioterrorism investigation, seized his computers, the exhibition that was planned to go in a museum in the next days, which included petri dishes and bacteria and many things that were considered possibly terrorist dangers. All of this just because his wife had died. It's not because he was actually monitored with anything considered terrorist. And was quite public about his art and exhibitions also in the past. His wife's body was confiscated during this investigation. Kurtz was released after 22 hours, and later it was found that all material was harmless. When the terrorism charges were dropped after a while, an investigation on a charge called mail and wire fraud was started instead, and this can lead up to 20 years of prison. The Critical Art Ensemble is rather well known for exhibitions, books, and public debate on issues such as GMO, biotechnology, but also electronic civil disobedience and digital resistance. There's many books they have written that are free for download on their website. What you're seeing up there is a picture to a film that was made by Lynn Hirschman, which is called Strange Culture, which is a great film that I advise you to see whenever you can. It's a mix of documentary and fiction about this case, and extremely good to see. It describes very well the kind of fear that is created around a terrorism case when people are being called to testify against someone they know who has been arrested for terrorism charges, for example, and what it does to you and for your life when something like this just kind of drops on you. Similarity to Andre Holmes' case in this case is that it's a critical researcher who was concerned, and the case has been dismissed now in April of this year, but until then, I think Steve Kurtz's life was focusing on terrorism more than on his other activities. This takes us to France. France has a new phenomenon, the ultra-left. In November of this year, just 1.5 months ago, 150 special police forces stormed a farm in a little village of 350 inhabitants in Tarnac. And there were raids also in Paris, in Rouen, in Limoges, and Metz. 10 people were detained. And 4 days later, this first detention after arrest can take up to four days. And 4 days later, 5 of them were formally arrested, and 5 others were released. One of them was the mother of one of the arrested. And they were charged, the 5 who were arrested, with criminal conspiracy with terrorist intentions. The accusation is property damage against the French train company SNCF, which caused delays for trains, and they were using what is called grapnels to damage the overhead contact wire. It's a kind of metal instrument that is hung over the overhead wires, and when the train goes in, this causes the wires to break and to come down, and then the train can't go on. 3 days before the arrests was the night when the Castor transport with nuclear waste was moving from France to Germany. You may remember this in the news. Then such an attack took place. And another had also taken place in October, which caused delays of high-speed trains, the TGV. In the second of these incidents on the 8th of November, the traffic of regional trains in the north of Paris was the result. The French, the Italian philosopher Giorgio Agamben published a text about the arrests in Libération, which is a leftist liberal daily paper in France, and I would like to quote from this text. "As for the result, one might expect that investigators found weapons, explosives, and Molotov cocktails on the farm in Millevaches. Far from it. The SDAT, that's the Special Terrorism Police, SDAT officers discovered documents containing detailed information on railway transportation, including exact arrival and departure times of trains. In plain French, an SNCF train schedule. But they also confiscated climbing gear, in simple French, a ladder, such as one might find in any country house. On the 2nd of December, some 3 weeks later, three of the remaining five were released, and now still in detention is the so-called leader of this criminal organization with terrorist intentions, who is called Julien Coupa, and his partner Ildun. The leader still faces up to 20 years in prison now with this charge. Just 2 days ago, he had an appeal in court and was denied release. Also here, the reason given by the prosecutor and the Minister for Internal Affairs is anarchist political ideas and contact to protest activities. There was an observation going on for 6 months before the arrests. Some asked questions like, if they were having this observation going on against these people, how would they manage to do these attacks against the train companies? And nobody has answered that so far. They were not actually caught in these attacks. They were just accused of having taken part in them. No weapons were found. So far, no evidence for participation in the sabotage became known. Instead, like I said, the train schedules, ladders, bolt cutters, or iron parts were found. Also, it was mentioned in the arrest warrants that the accused took part in a demonstration against a summit about immigration in Vichy earlier this year. Also, it is mentioned several times that there is a book which was possibly written by Julien Coupa, and it can be obtained legally by also, I think, through Amazon or at least in bookstores. But having possibly written this book or actually having this book at home and having read it is used as evidence against the suspects. It's interesting to understand that in April of this year, the Minister of Internal Affairs talks about the danger of anarcho-autonoms and the new ultra-left. Before, she also theorized about the danger of a revival of armed struggle in Paris or France as such. There is a wide public debate in France going on. There is another similarity here also with the case against André Holmes, since one of the suspects, the leader of the organization, is actually a philosopher himself and closely tied to elite university for social science in Paris. There's a lot of debate amongst philosophers about this. There's an open letter and a petition in his support signed by many academics. And there is a public debate in the media about this. What is terrorism? A debate that we had in Germany about a year ago also, and which keeps coming back. It is said that in times of the attacks of Bombay, these sabotage activities against trains, is that terrorism? This is one of the posters being done in support of the suspects. There is also an open letter by the parents of those who are accused who protest against their children being made to terrorists without any visible evidence actually being there. Maybe also interesting to note that this took place in this very little village somewhere in the middle of nowhere where since 2002 young people came to this lonely area that was more and more deserted and opened a little grocery store, reactivated a farm and mostly concentrated on political activity, yes, legal open political activity plus living in this area and taking care of themselves basically. The similarities, like I said, I think are quite obvious. My time is running short. I'm coming with this. I'm coming to, this is one of the arrests in that case. Coming to cases in Germany that I want to quickly mention. There was a case, a very similar case in Germany that was started in 1999 also, involving these grapnels, these metal things on the overhead wires of trains, relating to Castor transports of nuclear waste. That took place in 1996 and 1997, and then the result was one of the well-known paragraph 129A investigations, raids in 1992 against 11 suspects and 9 so-called concerned persons. It was never quite clear what their role was. This involved complete surveillance of phone GPS devices in cars, a copy machine that was used by one anti-nuclear activist group was completely monitored. And all national meetings of the anti-nuclear movement in Germany were completely observed by the police. The case was dropped years later without any result, but a lot of data was gathered about many of the political activists in Germany. Interesting here is that now the German police submitted names and information about this case to the French police, who are investigating the case in Tarnac in France. There's other cases that I'll just quickly mention. The terrorism investigation concerning the G8 summit in Germany, which was started. The G8 summit, you will remember this, was taking place in 2007 in Germany, in Heiligendamm. And there was a so-called terrorist organization aiming to attack the economic G8 summit. One month before the summit, there were raids in 40 places. It was an investigation against 18 people who were submitted to complete surveillance. When the raids took place, there was a police officer quoted on German TV saying, he didn't say that they didn't have clear evidence, but what he did say was that we just shot in the bush to see what starts to move when we try to stir up things a little bit. There was no evidence at all, just the assumption that there is this organization. This case was dropped in 2008, actually some days before the start of the trial against the three people who are now currently assumed to be the militant group. Another case, which is called the Bad Oldesloe case, was started in 2006 as well against first 4 and later 11 people. Raids in 15 apartments, and it's a case against young anti-fascists who all live in a little place in the north of Germany called Bad Oldesloe, who were not interested in the G8 summit, which was rather rare among political activists in Germany 1 year before the summit, because most everybody somehow tried to relate to this summit protest activities, which were clear to become quite big. But these anti-fascists were not interested in the G8 summit. They were interested in fascists and anti-fascist activities in their village, and this was seen to be highly conspiratorial and very suspicious by the police. If they never talked about the G8 summit on the phone, then they must have extremely conspiratorial methods of communicating to hide their interest in the G8 summit. The initial suspicion was against a couple that had both their mobile phones active in the same radio cell. An attack took place. They were actually accused of also attacking military vehicles and setting them on fire, I think. Another really hilarious story in this context is that one of the suspects used to have dreadlocks, like these long, funny hair. And at some point during the investigation, he cut them off. And you can find in the files a note about this incident when the German police tries to interpret why he has his hair cut off. And the only possible interpretation they can think, he must have been involved in some kind of arson attack, and then he probably burnt his hair to hide that he cut them off. There is no evidence, no proof for this. It's just a theory, but this is being put in the files and then used against them. What you see here up there is a GPS device that was found in one of the cars or under one of the cars of the defendants that became quite popular because it was found by the suspects and then through the lawyer that tried to give it back to the police, but the police said, it's not ours. And the Secret Service says, not ours. And so they said, well, we have this thing and nobody claims it's theirs. What do we do? Well, we keep it. And after a while, they were actually starting an investigation against the person who had found that thing for illegal possession of this GPS device. Which was then dropped by the judge in court, who said, well, if nobody claims it's theirs, it can't be illegally obtained or possessed. And the quotations in that thing, I advise you to research that. It's nice to read, except probably for the people concerned who still have it and nobody wants to have it back. And the last thing I want to mention is the several cases against people who are accused of being the militant group in Germany. The first case was became known in 2001 against first three people, later five people, with raids in six places over the years. They had complete surveillance, GPS, bugs in their apartments, video cameras outside their homes, phone and email monitored, listening devices during conversations. Andre also had this when they tried to follow a conversation between a suspect and another suspect. Civil clothes police take microphones and listening devices and try to follow them, for example, into a bar and try to listen to the conversation. And this also happened in this first case against the militant group. There's three different sets of files against different kinds of people who were accused to be militant group. Andre and three others being the fourth set of people who were said to be militant group. The first three cases, interestingly enough, were now finally closed just before the trial against the last group of three people who are currently said to be militant group after Andre was accused to be militant group. And so the first three sets were closed just some days before the trial was opened. And this trial is actually still going on now in the Berlin court in Moabit, and that in itself would fill a complete talk about very strange details, how this trial is being led. I'm not going into that because I only have 5 minutes left and maybe you want to ask some questions. Interesting detail still is that in all of the files to the different cases of the militant group, there's 2,000 people's names in the files who were at some point or the other checked by the police for criminal record or political activities. The last set we found when just some weeks ago we were handed over 82 new folders of files concerning Andre Holm. And it is widely believed that after the federal court in Germany decided that militant group is not a terrorist group, that the case against Andre was dropped. Far from it. The investigation is still going on. He is still being under surveillance, probably. We are not being told about the details of this, but recently got all of these new files that show quite clearly that we are being monitored quite closely, including public events that we do. Also outside the country, and it is visible in the files that both Secret Service, which is Verfassungsschutz, and the Federal Police are reading my blog to understand better about where we are and what we do. For example, what really quite irritated me, even though it's not surprising to hear that an address book with many phone numbers was found on my desk during the raid of our apartment, and all people in there, old school friends, colleagues, whoever, was closely checked by the police, noted whether they have some kind of police record and whatever else activities they may have engaged in. One really interesting little last detail that I would like to add is that we found in the files that the German police found several encrypted files on Andre's computer. And we are happy to announce that the Federal Police in Germany apparently is not able to decrypt GNU-PG files. There's an interesting communication when the Federal Police is looking at the files and wondering what they are and looking at the kind of files they are. They, after a while, detect them, this must be PGP. And then they try to find out how to decrypt this kind of thing. And And they are told that there is this professor at the Department of Information Systems and Information Management at the University of Cologne, Professor Dr. Detlef Schoder, and they ask him for help to decrypt the files, and Professor Schoder offers to send his assistant, Martin Wundram, to have a look at several encrypted files found on Andre's computer. Professor Schoder, just for looking at the files, not for attempting to decrypt them, just for looking at this, wanted to charge the federal police €5,000. The federal police in Germany said, so what are you going to do? Is this going to be successful? And then the professor said that, well, he has some powerful machines trying to decrypt, and actually it must be admitted that they also found Andre's private key on this computer. But with this private key, what he was going to do is basically guess passphrases. And said that if the passphrases are any longer than 8 characters, and if they contain any special characters, it's practically impossible to decrypt. So now you know how to save your files. Pass phrases longer than 8 signs and special characters, and you can be considered pretty safe. The federal police dropped the offer, didn't want to waste the €5,000, and we don't know what they are doing with these encrypted files so far. Just some quick conclusions to what I've told you this far. I think there is a public perception of what terrorism is. This public perception is fed daily by politicians and by the media. It creates fear of bomb attacks, of biological or chemical attacks against the wide public in Europe or North America and most everywhere in the world. The public perception of terrorism is I think, one that involves many deaths, similar to the legal definition, which says terrorism intimidates the populations, it threatens governments or states. It's something like 9/11 or the bomb attacks on Madrid or London. But this hardly ever takes place, at least in Europe or North America. When we look at Central Asia, this is an entirely different thing, but that's not what people are afraid of here. On the other hand, there is a lot of anti-terrorist prosecution taking place. This includes many trials and also prison terms for people and surveillance against a huge number of people. These cases hardly ever involve violence against people, with some exceptions that have a long tradition and history, for example, the ETA in the Basque country or the Corsican groups that are trying to separate from France. But I think all the other cases would not be considered to be terrorist by most people. What is not comprised by this definition of terrorism is right-wing violence, which happens so much and kills so many people, but this also is not being labeled as terrorist, even though I would consider that by far more terrorist than attacks against trains or even maybe setting fire to laboratories, which is debatable, no doubt, but also doesn't endanger people and doesn't kill anyone. What is similar in these investigations, more so I can talk about Germany here because I don't know the details about the other countries, is that I have the impression that the investigations often look to prove their case and they interpret all possible evidence against the suspects. If you show some behavior that contradicts the suspicion, e.g. you don't talk about special subject, you are not interested in certain things, you don't have anything to do with certain people who are facing the same charges, the only possible interpretation for the police can be that you are extremely conspiratorial about it, that you must have certain ways that make it necessary to even enforce more observation and more surveillance to find out your terrorist activity. And there is no visible evidence, it means the suspects must be working harder to hide suspicious or criminal behavior. I think in public perception, terrorism now is perceived as fundamentalist Islamic terrorism. The terrorism investigations that are going on here now concern groups and individuals who express political dissent, who are involved in political actions and sometimes property damages, and sometimes even with a lot of financial damage, but without people being hurt or being killed. There's no comparison, for example, to the attack in Oklahoma City in 1995 when 168 people were killed. Europol counts 583 cases of terrorist attacks in the European Union in 2007. This is from the Europol report on terrorist attacks in Europe in 2007. More of 500 of these are so-called separatist attacks, mostly, like I said, by ETA and the Corsican movements, but also 15 in Germany. When I saw that, I wondered, 15 separatist terrorist attacks in 2007 in Germany? How did I miss that? Interesting theory. Looking at the report, I found out that these 15 attacks are said to have been done by the PKK, the Kurdish, by now illegal party in Germany, mostly against Turkish travel agencies and such. I was wondering about Frisians, for example, or the Sorbs, but Bavaria is also an interesting theory. There is a graph which was done by the magazine Der Spiegel and is still on their website now, and their interpretation of terrorist attacks in Europe comprises exactly two, and that's the one in Madrid and the one in London and no other terrorism. That's the different perceptions of terrorism that is taking place today in Europe. I think the public debate about terrorism causes a lot of fear, and it allows more and tighter laws and more surveillance against everyone. Terrorism cases are often cases against either people of Arabic background or political activists or critical researchers who deal with topics considered to be suspicious. Often the terrorism charges dropped quickly, like you saw in the cases I talked about, but the investigations go on, the data are collected, and a lot of fear in the population is created through the first announcement of again 10 violent terrorists who have been arrested. My perception of terrorism is exactly that, the public debate that intimidates the population and undermines democracy. And that's where I'm ending now. Thank you. Thank you.
Well, thanks a lot for that great talk. And we run a wee bit of short of time here. Maybe we have, can we have three questions? And if you could just pass around the mic wherever you see a hand coming up. And if there are no questions, that's good too, but if there probably are.
Do you know the case of terrorism in Cologne? There were two suspects arrested at the airport after being searched, and there was some letter found, apparently some kind of, well, I'm going to blow myself up. And the BKA officially statement that they have been monitoring them for months and that they're evil terrorists and so on. Later on, turns out that was just a love letter from his girlfriend.
Yes, of course. There's so many cases like that, and I just could pick some very few, and you could go on forever. I'm writing about these things on my blog, and I've also mentioned this case. I find it extremely interesting because it concerns, again, two Arab men who were arrested with a huge public announcement, and later they were released because no evidence was found. It's exactly one of those cases.
Is there another hand? Can you just start to speak as soon as you've got the mic? Okay. All right. You can just come up here if you like. That's probably easier.
Hi. My name's Star Simpson. I was arrested in Boston in 2007 and charged with possession of a hoax device, which consisted officially of 13 LEDs. Hearing your talk has made me think that there ought to be some sort of tool or way of helping people who find themselves in these situations, because in my experience, and possibly also in yours, it's impossible to predict or see it coming, and the thing you need most is help. So I'd like to pose to the Congress thoughts on what can be done.
Excellent idea. I think a support network that helps people when they are all of a sudden faced with something like that is extremely needed.
Well, thank you for your talk.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for coming. And the next talk will be up soon.
Also, if I may add, I'm going to be here in the next day, so if you have more questions or something you want to say, maybe not in public, you can just come to me and talk to me or send me an email. My mail address is also in my blog. Thank you very much.